7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us in the studios this morning Paul Loeb, local writer and author of many books, but the latest one being Soul of a Citizen, and we're going to be talking about those very issues. Paul, thank you for coming in this morning.
Glad to be here.
Let's start out. We just had an experience this last weekend of incredible protests, both here in Seattle and across the nation, across the world. A lot of people turning out, a lot of people you wouldn't expect turning out into the streets and spending a day opposing a war with Iraq. And myself, I kind of found it a letdown a couple days later. You know, you have this big high of seeing all these people, and then boom, you're kind of asking yourself, gosh, what do I do now? And luckily, you have written a book that addresses just that.
Right. No, I think there definitely were just huge numbers of people. I mean, I was joking that probably everybody I knew in Seattle was at the march, and yet I only ran into about five people I knew. But later on, you know, I would run into people in this last week and saying, oh, yeah, you were there. Yeah, great march. And you know, that was a measure of its size. I mean, my guess is that there were 35 to 40,000 people, and I really, not counting the WTO, I think it was the largest peace march we've had, maybe ever. I mean, it was just astounding. And they weren't always the usual suspects. I mean, I live in West Seattle, and so we were taking the bus down and talking with people at the bus stop, you know, and I said, because I'm always curious, well, you know, have you been real active lately? And, you know, they said, well, no, you know, feeling like I, you know, ought to be getting active and that this is really important, but this is kind of the first thing that I've done, and I'm not quite sure how to plug in. I mean, one of the things that happens is when the newspapers, as they did, announce it, you get a huge extra turnout because people who aren't plugged into the connected networks know that something is happening and they know where to go and they come out. And you know, it was amazing just coming down on this peace bus, essentially the 56 from West Seattle, where everybody on the bus had signs and buttons or was asking to borrow somebody else's signs or buttons, and you come down and you feed in, and you know, the same is going from, you know, every neighborhood in the city and the suburban areas, and it really was amazing. And then, you know, if you even reading the mainstream press, but, you know, particularly if you tied into, I mean, I usually go to commondreams.org for a lot of my info, you know, and you realize that, yeah, there are 7 or 8 or 10 million people worldwide on that weekend who are saying, wait a minute, we just don't want this. And so on that is a astounding moment. And I think it's important for us, you know, when we're trying to sort of assess both what's going on and where do we fit in it, to recognize how powerful it is. I mean, particularly that, you know, this is before war has started, that you have this amazing global movement. You have a huge movement in this country. I mean, I keep getting these emails from people all over the country because I tend to send my stuff out. Soul of a Citizen developed this huge, the website soulofacitizen.org. People go in, they sign up for my email articles, and they, you know, I have this network across the country. And so I get these emails from Traverse City, Michigan, saying, yep, our demonstrations are growing there. And you know, even locally here at home, I remember somebody, this was back in October, saying, it was from Everett, saying, well, we've been having vigils on the main, I think it was Hewlett, the main drag in Everett, and or maybe Colby. And, you know, of course, people are responding really well. And I'm thinking, I emailed back and said, you know, don't take for granted that, of course, because my closest friend who grew up in Everett, his dad was a Lutheran preacher who was run out of town during Vietnam for preaching against the war. And, you know, Everett's not necessarily the hospitable turf. So the fact that people are responding well is tremendously encouraging. So I think that, you know, one of the things to just that we have to recognize that should give us hope is the breadth of the response. I mean, again, you look at the religious community. I mean, you never saw, I mean, during Vietnam, the Catholic Church was so intimately tied, it was almost inextricable with the early days of, I mean, plucking DM from a Catholic, I think it was at a monastery we was hanging out, you know, and installing him as the president of Vietnam. And I mean, they were working with the CIA so closely, and you know, obviously by the end there were folks like the Berrigans, but nonetheless, that hierarchy was not exactly peace-oriented. And you go now and all the Catholic bishops are opposing the war and all the major Protestant denominations, and you know, you start to have some significant labor folks, and you've got major institutions weighing in that really did not weigh in during Vietnam, if at all, ever, till the very last period of the war. And so all of that is tremendous progress. I think the challenge, this is, you know, the long way of looping back to your question is, for those of us who are involved in what I would call connected networks, there's not a shortage of things to do. I mean, you come home and you get the email for the virtual, what is it, the 26th or the 27th, the MoveOn.org's virtual call, and United for Peace's virtual call-in, where people are going to be bombarding senators, congressmen, the White House, with, you know, constant stream of faxes and phone calls. That gives you something to do. There is the, I guess it was March 6th or 7th, the stay home from work, you know, do something for peace. I mean, there's groups coming up with projects to do. And I don't think that there's going to be a shortage of that. My concern are what if you're not connected? What about the person who was next to me on the bus, who I in fact said, okay, here's the Snow Coalition's, you know, list, and I'm now the board chair of Peace and Justice Alliance, which used to be Washington Peace Action Alliance, and here's our info, and, you know, I could, you know, manually connect this individual person, but there are 50,000 or 40,000 people at that march, probably three quarters of whom were not necessarily part of the networks. And that's where it gets complicated. I mean, I think that we made, and, you know, and in the flux of doing everything, you know, it's hard to think of everything, we made one mistake, those of us, those more organized the march, which is, at the very least, they should have, at every single march, give out the four or five main websites of the groups that are putting it together, so that everybody can then log in. I mean, I would go beyond that and do the very, very labor-intensive and a little bit expensive task at a major march of getting sign-in sheets that are then given over to the main organizers of the march, so that, you know, you're put on these lists if you're not already on them. Because what happens is, you know, let's say, particularly say if a war does happen, I mean, as is possible, the propaganda barrage will escalate. The newspapers will not be printing the addresses of the peace rallies. You know, if you are not connected, if you are connected, you will find out that people are still acting, marching all over the country. If you're not, you're going to feel isolated. You're going to feel demoralized. You're going to feel like the only idiot who cares. John Ashcroft is going to call you a traitor. I mean, all the rest of this stuff will happen. And I think it's so critical to get these new folks who are coming in and connect them to their fellow citizens, so that they can then sit down in a West Seattle or Ballard or Edmonds or Burien or wherever neighborhood group and say, okay, let's come up with something that we can do. And that makes all the difference in the world. And it also makes a difference in what can be done, but it also makes such a difference in whether or not people can keep on. Because this society will try its best to isolate people who are dissenting. And they do a damn good job of it. And if you're just sitting there watching the TV, you will feel powerless. And so to me, the biggest, I mean, I'm writing, actually together with Job Parrish, who, you know, comes on the next half hour, Job and I are writing an article about, okay, say we do go to war, and I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. I mean, I think that the peace movement globally has thrown up a whole lot of nets to kind of rein, you know, the Bush folks in, and we may well prevail, and that's very possible. But, you know, we have to look at both possibilities. And that the major task of the movement, or as major as trying to prevent this war, is how do you take this flood of people and give them a way to be able to participate? Because if we can do that, if we can connect them to each other, then we have a very, very powerful movement for change that can do a lot of different things.
I know we're all pretty much told, and it's repeated over and over since the day we're born, is that as a single person, you know, you can't really affect things. You're not really going to change the big picture. And in your book, Soul of a Citizen, you point out that it's the exact opposite is true.
Right. And I mean, I use, for instance, it's a story where if I have a couple minutes, I'll tell that story. I use the Rosa Parks story because it's the quintessential image that we have of social change. Well, we have two, the society has two images. It has the negative image, the crazies. But if they're trying to go to the positive image of social change, it's Parks or Martin Luther King. And yet, time and time and again, it's clear to me that people have the image completely wrong. And it came to me, I was being interviewed on CNN. Parks was on the show by telephone, and they introduced her by saying, one day she was riding the bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and she just refused to start, move to the back of the bus, and that started the civil rights movement. And it's such nonsense because it sounds like this woman acts totally alone, totally individually, totally on a whim. Things instantly change. And the reality is she had been involved in the NAACP for 12 years. She was a secretary of the NAACP. She'd gone to training sessions at Highlander, the Labor and Civil Rights Center in Tennessee that's still going to this day. She acted very, very consciously as part of a conscious movement. With perseverance, I mean, it was 12 years. We wouldn't have ever heard of her if she'd given up in year 9. And that lesson is worth repeating and repeating and repeating, because what it says is you don't act alone. I mean, I remember Garrison Keillor, well-meaningly on Prairie Home Companion, Martin Luther King Day of a couple years ago, said, you know, Rosa Parks wasn't an activist. She was just a woman with her groceries who was tired. And I'm thinking, no, I'm sorry, she was an activist. And part of the nature of an activist is that you connect with the structures that give you, that amplify your actions, that give them more power, that give you a sense that you're working with other people and give you the power to support each other, to come up with ideas, to brainstorm in their case, to say, okay, you know, they did some boycotts in Baton Rouge, they did some boycotts in Mobile, maybe we could do the same. And that's the difference between feeling helpless cursing out the TV, which, you know, all of us do from time to time, and feeling empowered and actually going ahead and doing something, is that connectivity. But we, you know, our society, because we are such an individualist society, teaches us that even social action proceeds as, you know, the lone heroic individuals and not through common efforts. And so when we think of, well, how are we going to act for change, we end up, and this is, you know, the key theme of Soul of a Citizen, is you don't do it alone. You do it with other people. And God knows we need that lesson more than ever now.
A lot of what we're hearing in the media, and we've heard this in the past, is the worship of heroes.
Yes.
And certainly with the upcoming actions in Iraq, the heroes are going to be painted as the U.S. soldiers that are going in. And again, getting back to your book, you have numerous examples of heroes, average everyday heroes, that basically are people we run into, you know, every day.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because, I mean, the Pentagon's been pretty upfront about the strategy. It's, okay, you get the people working with the unions, you do the human interest stories, you get the portrait of this person, and I'm going to go in there and I'm going to have full resolve, and I'm, you know, and yes, I'm going to risk my life. And you know, the interesting thing, I go back to, I remember years ago, I was on the radio in Boston with some active Vietnam veterans, and it was during the Afghanistan, you know, war, that where we were backing the Mujahideen and helping create Bin Laden and all those other pretty things, and, you know, laying the ground for the Taliban and, you know, all the stuff that's coming back to haunt us now. And this Vietnam vet said, you know, I really empathize with those poor Russian soldiers who are dropped down in a country that they don't know the language, they don't know the culture, they're told they're fighting for freedom, they're told they're doing a good thing, people are shooting with them, they're shooting back. He said, that was my experience in Vietnam. You know, that was what I went through. And I didn't know any better, and I just did the best I can. And that's what happens to the soldiers. And I think that, I mean, it's interesting, I got a letter from a woman, I think it was in Indiana, that she'd sent to Bush with a color Xerox of her, with her arm around her son in full uniform, saying, you know, this is my son. Don't think of him as military force. He's a human being. You are putting his life at risk. I mean, when I was marching this last week, there was a woman whose son was in the Navy and had a picture around her neck of him. You know, and I think the question that we have to keep raising all the more when the war happens is, you know, if people are, I mean, let's honor the impulse of the soldiers to be willing to sacrifice their lives. I mean, you know, it is an honorable impulse on some level. But let's also ask that question that says, for what purpose? Because, you know, any soldier, I mean, you know, you could be defending the German Reich and you're being willing to sacrifice your life as a brave young German soldier. So let's ask the question of, and I'm not saying, you know, it's equivalent, they're Nazis or anything like that, but what I am saying is that we have to say, if a society is being willing to sacrifice these people's lives, the soldiers' lives, let alone the lives of the people that they're going to kill in far greater numbers because of our technology, to what purpose? to what end? And is it a, you know, and not enough to say to the end of deposing a ruthless dictator, because, you know, he is a ruthless dictator, but is this going to make the world safer? You know, is it going to make Iraq a better country? You know, will it make the people in Iraq safer? I mean, all those hard questions that get swept under the rug. And if somebody, I mean, if our soldiers, some of them are going to die, and, you know, they may die from the depleted uranium shells, you know, we're hearing, you know, as high as 7,000 or 8,000 may end up now dying of that from the first Gulf War. You know, if they're going to die in a cause, we better be damn sure that it's a worthy cause. And if not, then we, you know, as this woman said in this letter to Bush, we are playing with their lives. And so I remember Mike Lowry during the first Gulf War, you know, saying, which was, you know, a wonderful way of phrasing, said, of course we love our brave young men and women in the service. The question is, who is putting them in harm's way and for what purpose? And I think that's the question that we have to be asking again and again. You know, for what purpose? Who's putting them in? What costs are, I mean, you know, remember during Vietnam, No senator's son ever died. No congressman ever died. No cabinet member's son ever died. I mean, these were not the people doing the dying. Certainly the same is true now. And of course, you know, as people have pointed out, you know, we've got the administration of the chicken hawks, you know, rushing us to war while, you know, the folks who maybe, you know, even some of the military generals, I was asking the provost at the Air Force Academy, we were having, sitting next to each other by chance at an academic conference. And, you know, what's the response of the Air Force Academy? Is that, you know, we've got very grave reservations about this, you know, about mission creep. And, you know, there's a lot of people who don't think this is a good idea who are in the military. You know, said, you know, once we're called up, we've got little choice, but we're not rushing to go in. And I think that's, you know, it's critical that we, and very tricky because the media will immediately say, you know, support the troops, you know, coupled with the myths that, I mean, I remember, during the first Gulf War, they hammered away at this myth of spitting on soldiers during Vietnam, which was largely a media myth. I mean, you know, happened very, very, very rarely. I mean, hell of a lot more peace demonstrators were spat on, you know, by hostile folks than soldiers were spat on by peace demonstrators. But it became a kind of metaphor to how the vets were treated, that is, rejected by their society, which was true, you know, including by the people who fought in World War II, like, we won our war, why didn't you win yours? And it's been used very consciously and shaped into a myth to bash the peace movement. And so people, I remember during the first Gulf War, you know, these nice, well-meaning young marchers said, well, we're not going to spit on the soldiers this time. And I said, well, good that you're not going to spit on them because they don't deserve to be spat on, but recognize that they may not have been spat on last time.
So we're at a point in the country where there seems to be, at least amongst the people, not necessarily amongst the media or amongst our leaders,
right,
a lot more discussion about what is going on, at least than in previous times that I've seen. But another thing that you point out is that we need to keep pushing down different barriers, and one of those is reaching beyond our comfort zone on talking to others. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's very important to gather. I mean, this is, you know, the talk I'm giving March 1st at 7 o'clock at St. Mark's. I mean, that's part of what I'll be talking about, is that it's important to gather with folks of like mind, because that reminds us that we're not alone. But if that's all we do, we lose. I mean, one of the reasons I think that the neighbor groups that the Snow Coalition and you know, the person who initiated it was from Peace and Justice Alliance that I'm working with as board chair, Fred Miller, that initiated those groups. One of the reasons that they're so important is that suddenly, you know, there are folks out there, a friend of mine, you know, we're in Burien, Des Moines, you know, and it's a Burien, Des Moines local peace group that can try and reach out to folks there. And it's not just Capitol Hill. I mean, you know, although even if here you are on Capitol Hill, part of the challenge is get folks who haven't been involved. You know, and even if it gets uncomfortable, because we're going to need huge numbers of people. And there's an awful lot of people, when you look at the response to the war, where they're saying, well, yeah, maybe it's a good idea, but, you know, if we do it alone, I'm not so excited about it. If a bunch of people die, I'm not so excited. I mean, you know, they're defining the real conditions that, in fact, are occurring. And they're saying, if this happens, I've got reservations. And we need to be able to reach out to those folks in goodwill and say, you know, this is why I am concerned. And I know that, you know, I know you don't like Saddam Hussein. Well, I don't either. I know you're worried about terrorism, but this isn't going to make it better. We've got to have those hard conversations. I mean, one of the things that I write about in Soul of a Citizen, you know, different issue, but same kind of principle, is amazing thing where my friend, my closest friend, a guy named Pete Knudsen, is a commercial fisherman. We were actually kicked out of Stanford together for anti-war activism 30 years ago. And he was in parts of the fights around saving the family fishing operations. A few years ago, there was an initiative that was put together by some of the big commercial interests to ban family fishing. And the coalitions they put together included because it was a greenwashing initiative, you know, the Sierra Club and Friends of the Earth and, you know, the enviro groups weighing in saying, no, this isn't an environmental initiative, it's an anti-environmental initiative, and the Native American tribes who Pete had been working with and the family fishermen. But they also brought in, it was amazing, they brought in some of the fishermen were members of very fundamentalist churches like Assembly of God. And, you know, you don't usually see the Assembly of God churches as part of progressive coalitions. I mean, they're not the Unitarians. But we had an Assembly of God preacher preaching from the state capitol in Olympia on the steps about corporate greed and the dangers of corporate greed, and sending a letter to all the different churches out. And there was a TV show that had first done something hostile to the fishermen. And the guy goes in, one of the fishermen who was a member of the one of these conservative churches, said, you know, Jesus worked with fishermen. I mean, what do you think what's going to happen when Jesus comes back and finds out you've been attacking fishermen? He's going to rip your head off. And, this is not the usual suspects. You know, this is outreach. I mean, I write about it in Soul of a Citizen. This is outreach well beyond the core converted, and it's critical. I mean, that means we got to put ourselves in, you know, perhaps uncomfortable situations, but there where we say, look, this is going to affect everything. We better have a conversation about it. And I remember, you know, this is a while ago, running into a friend of mine who was the baseball coach in Yakima and was very, very outspoken against the Vietnam War. And, you know, it's clear to me that at that point that, you know, there began to be a significant presence in Yakima against the war. That was when that war began to turn. And, you know, one of the heartening things, again, is, you know, there wasn't just the big seven demonstration in Seattle. There was a demonstration in Spokane, and there was a small one in Yakima and, you know, Linden and on and on and on. And, you know, that's really important, because it's not just saying, here are the usual folks. It's saying, in places where we don't expect dissent, it's happening. And again, we may have to push ourselves if we live on, you know, on Capitol Hill or something, to find ways to reach out. But we got to do that, because that's what transforms this from a movement, you know, that's, you know, got some power, got some clout, to one that really has the power to carry the day.
And I know that's one of the big areas that I'm personally working on. And I'm finding, if nothing else, even when you're talking to people, you know, walking into it, that you anticipate that you disagree with them almost to 100%, just the act of listening to them and listening closely to what they're saying actually is really empowering. Because for one thing, if you listen closely, you actually hear that you find things that you agree with.
Yes. Yeah. And the more you can do that, I mean, the more you can say, all right, we agree with this. We have no argument here. You know, but, you know, what are you going, you know, what is your, you know, I mean, why is it that General Zini of the Middle East Command, you know, Formidable Command, and Wesley Clark of NATO, and even Norman Schwarzkopf are raising reservations? I mean, these are not historic peace activists. Why is it that they've got these reservations and, you know, are talking about the way that this is going to encourage Islamic terrorism and polarize the world against us? I mean, well, Brent Scowcroft, I mean, from the, you know, first Bush administration. So I think that, you know, in those dialogues, we can say, there are people like you. I mean, I would have loved it if there had been somebody on the podium at the big march who said, you know, I'm a Republican. I don't even agree with you folks on a lot of stuff, but you know what? This war is absolutely wrong because of A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You know, I mean, that was part of the, during some of the WTO stuff, part of the power of Brian Dardowski, you know, is he was a Republican. I mean, I don't think it was a very typical Republican, I have to say, but, you know, nonetheless, he was a historically Republican saying, you know, this global trade stuff is not about democracy. And you know, being able to have those kinds of bridges is real powerful.
We have about 5 minutes left. I want to ask you about another thing you hit on, is that people shouldn't necessarily wait until they become an expert on something before they start to get involved.
Yeah. Yeah, let me, if we have 5 minutes, let me just give a couple things that are important. One is there is a website, soulofacitizen.org, that has tons of info on the book, my speaking, including the St. Mark's Date. I mean, more than, you know, all the articles I've been writing on this stuff, it's a good resource. And that, again, I'm speaking at St. Mark's, 7 o'clock Saturday, March 1st, next Saturday, that is. And it's going to be we're going to try and raise some money for snow and PGA, and, you know, although it's free at the door. And I speak a lot around the country. I don't end up speaking that much in Seattle because I'm usually gone. So it's a nice, you know, time to be able to hear me ask questions, all the rest of that. I, you know, hope folks will come and tell folks.
Yeah, it's a rare treat.
Yeah. So one of the, you know, the themes, as you're saying, is the question of knowing how much you know. And, you know, we hear this from the White House: you don't know the real facts. We have the secret information. You know, if you really saw what we had, you'd be convinced. And what's interesting is that's tapping into not just a sort of distinct theme of this war, but an ongoing theme by which the sort of people, the pundits, the politicians, the folks who shape our culture say, you don't know enough. You have no standing to act. And one of the things I discovered in writing Soul of a Citizen is it's a notion I call the perfect standard, which says, no matter how much I know about an issue, I don't have standing, therefore I better shut my mouth. Or I'm not a person of, you know, impeccable moral character. I'm not Gandhi, King, Rosa Parks, so I better shut my mouth. And it's really pounded into us from the culture, and it's garbage, because in fact, when I look at anybody who takes a stand, even the people who are, you know, the absolute veterans, they all started out with uncertainties. They all started out learning as they went. They all started out with hesitations. You know, you see that in Rosa Parks' career. You see this in King. You see this in anybody. And we got to remember that it's not about being the quiz show person on social change. It's saying, okay, here's what I think. I'm going to get involved in this, and I'm going to learn as I go. And I guarantee if you do, 6 months down the line, people may look at you as an expert, and they say, well, you know a lot, but I don't. But it's a process of learning. So it's absolutely critical that we just set aside that barrier, and we say, all right, let's recognize that these people who've insisted that they know everything, they, in fact, are the ones who've gotten us into this mess. They are the ones who armed bin Laden and armed Saddam Hussein to begin with and overthrew the Shah of, overthrew the democracy in Iran and installed the Shah, which led us to support it, to Khomeini, which led us supporting Saddam Hussein against the fundamentalists in Iran, and on and on and on. These folks who say they know everything and are so confident, their historical record gives them no moral or historical or pragmatic even standing to insist that they know more than we do. In fact, probably the reverse. So let's be confident that we have the ability to learn and to understand this stuff too. We have to do this, because certainly in wartime it's going to escalate.
All right, so we're all jazzed from last weekend's protests. We're reinvigorated from hearing you this morning. What's the next step?
I would say the next step is connect with other folks. Connect with other folks and find something that reaches out. You know, maybe it's that, you know, that vigil in the neighborhood, putting a table in Wallingford or Edmonds or Burien or wherever you happen to live. You know, a bunch of people crossing the main 2-minute intersection in West Seattle with signs. You know, putting up that sign, talking with folks, going block to block, you know. Just, you know, you have standing with anybody on your block because you live on that block. And then, you know, they like, you know, just, I'm a neighbor. I want to talk about having a house, you know, meeting on your block and saying, meet your neighbors, let's talk. We may not agree about this stuff, but this is important. And if nothing else, we'll have a chance to talk with each other and connect. That's important. The more we do it in an organized way, the more power it has. But, you know, that to me is the key, is bringing out those folks who aren't involved already, because A, if we stop this war, we're going to need them to stop it. And if we do go to war, we're going to need them to understand, by being connected with us, that going to war is a betrayal, regardless of if it's a 5-day war or a 50-day war or a 5-year war, that, you know, it is a betrayal of any human value. And they're not going to get that if they, you know, watching the news or even reading the newspapers. They're going to get that by being connected to some kind of alternative which we can offer them.
All right. With that, we are out of time. Talking this morning with writer and author Paul Loeb, author of Soul of a Citizen. And Paul, where can people find your book?
Most of the Seattle stores, Elliott Bay, your bookstore, whatever, do have it. If you go to the website, Soul of a Citizen, or you can browse it, which is nice, browse sections of it, and then order it from a good independent store like we have in this area and support them. And easy enough to get. Harder if you're listening on the internet, find an independent store in your neighborhood. And it's actually up to 85,000 copies in print, but it's all word of mouth. It's never very visible at the chains. So, it's a good resource for people keeping on. That's what I'm hearing from everybody who's read it. It's soulofacitizen.org. And then, come hear me. If you come on to St. Mark's, you can get an autographed copy.
All right. And that'll be March 1st at 7 o'clock. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Very good.